And we're back. It's already been 11 months since the last Other 5 Billion podcast episode was posted. I look back at this time and I feel really sad not to have done more. However, I have a happy and healthy 7-month-old son to show for it. So all's well that ends well. And finally today, we bridge the gap and bring you a new episode. What have the animals done for us? My name is Olga, and I've been wondering about that question for a really long time. And the Other 5 Billion podcast is my way of answering it and sharing with you what I found out along the way. Working animals. Dogs, cats, horses, donkeys, even elephants, and more species have been domesticated by us to help us live more comfortably and to prosper. Today, we're going to be speaking with Melissa Liszewski, who has spent her entire career helping to improve the lives of working animals in several continents. When recording this episode, I must admit that I did feel quite emotional. And the reason behind that was realising just how many animals are still working hard for us today. But every cloud has a silver lining. And during our conversation, I found out how the issue is being broken down into really actionable steps and what's actually being done to improve the conditions for working animals, millions of them, all the time. Now, I've wanted to do an episode about horses since I read a book called The Story of Inventions by Jeremy Hornsby, and he talks about the fact that in 1890 there was quite an amazing invention, and that's the horseshoe. It allowed us to explore far further than we could have done before and allowed us to progress as a species far further than we probably would have done without the horse and the donkey by our side. And I think by the time that you finish this episode, you will agree that Melissa is someone who embodies exactly what this podcast is designed to convey. That the human species depends so much on what other animals have done for us. So, no time like the present. Let's get on with the show. And here is an introduction from our guest, Melissa Liszewski.
I'm Melissa Liszewski, and I'm Senior Program Manager for Community Engagement at the International Fund for Animal Welfare. In a nutshell, I work on the people side of animal welfare and conservation.
I'm delighted to have somebody like yourself actually here, because I think you're living a childhood dream for a lot of people. I meet these people a lot, so they really wanted to work with animals when they were children, and then their parents or a school counselor or somebody told them that they'll never find a job or it won't pay the bills. And you're actually doing this and doing something that a lot of people have foregone to go and get the paycheck but not really feel happy. Could you let us a little bit about how you got to where you are today, please?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it definitely wasn't an easy or a quick journey for me. I always loved animals, as far as I can remember, always wanted to help them. But I kind of thought as a kid, you know, the only way to do that is to be a vet. So a couple years into the pre-vet track, a few things kind of happened at the same time that made me really change my course. And the first was when I was working as a vet assistant at an emergency clinic. And in one day, we euthanized nearly 30 animals. And most of those animals actually could have been saved if their owners had sought treatment sooner or gotten their animal vaccinated, kept them on a lead near a busy highway, you know, these types of things. I was actually more passionate about working with people to prevent the cause of animal suffering than I was about treating the symptoms of animal suffering. So that was kind of the first turning point for me. And the second was I got involved in a small project to help working horses in Southeast Brazil. And, you know, we were focusing on ensuring owners had the information they needed to care for their animals, linking them up with vet services. And really, when we finally went down to Brazil in the summer of 2006 to implement the project, the minute I stepped into a community in Brazil and sat down to speak with an animal owner, I was completely hooked. So really from there on out, I spent the next 7 years doing any relevant course or extracurricular activity, any networking opportunity I could find. The exact academic path I felt I needed didn't really exist, So I pieced together my own path to get a master's degree in animal science focused on behavior and welfare, and including joint specializations in both international development and social science. I was definitely the oddball in the animal science department at the time, but I forged ahead and I made sure I spent a little bit of time each summer volunteering on projects, searching LinkedIn for people doing jobs that I thought I would love to do, and sending them my CV, starting a conversation. And I think that's kind of how eventually 7 years later, I ended up in my dream role, and one thing kind of led to the other. So I think my advice to anyone looking to break into this sector is always to be patient, because it may actually take a 5-year strategy rather than a 5-month strategy to get where you want to go. And I think it's also really important to be clear about what you want to contribute to this field and the unique perspective or skills that you're bringing to the sector, and then network like crazy. The good jobs in this field really don't come up very often. And when you do, there tend to be a lot of applicants. So I think you always have a bit of the competitive edge if people already know who you are and recognize your name before your application even lands in that stack on their desk.
And actually, just a side question. So say someone is going through what you went through earlier in your career, and mm-hmm. say they contact you, would you be quite happy to respond to them, or do you find yourself too busy? Like, what's the best way for somebody to actually get that advice if they're starting out?
Definitely. Like, I'm always happy when people get hold of my email address and reach out or message me on LinkedIn. I personally am always happy to share my thoughts and ideas and to give people advice for whatever it's worth, because, you know, I know that's how I got to where I am today, is people kind of paying it forward back in the day. And so I'm really happy that kind of thing.
Great. Well, hopefully we can inspire a few people to do just that today. That would be wonderful. Good. And so then you were working at Brook for almost 6 years, and then now you're actually newly appointed trustee for Spanna, which is S-P-A-N-A for our listeners. Is there a way you could just summarize what these organizations stand for and what they do?
Yeah, so both of these organizations work to improve the welfare of working animals around the world. Brook, specifically through advocacy, capacity building of local animal health services, and engaging animal-owning communities that care for horses, donkeys, and mules. And Spanna, through veterinary treatment of all species of working animals, training owners and professionals, and teaching the next generation the importance of being kind to animals.
Could you actually sort of take our listeners on one of the field visits that you could remember that you've done?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is thinking back to my very first visit to Ethiopia. The program there and the team there grew very close to my heart, and the project work there. So it was a very special time. And, you know, I remember stepping off my overnight flight from London in Addis Ababa, dressed completely wrong for hot morning temperatures, even at 8 a.m. My colleagues were there to whisk me away to the office for the most delicious but the strongest coffee of my life. Get a little security briefing. And then we were actually straight off from there for a 6-hour drive south for a project site visit. So I was absolutely exhausted, but funnily enough, I could not tear myself away from all of the sights and sounds along that 6-hour car ride to take a nap. I was just so happy to be there and so excited for what was ahead. So we spent really the next few days consisting of typically 2 to 3 meetings a day at a variety of different project sites. Usually we'd kind of start the morning meeting with urban taxi horse owners and renters associations and visiting a few of their homes to check out the animals in the stables. And then actually that first day we were there, it happened to be market day in the town. So we walked mm-hmm. to the local market. We checked out the hundreds of donkeys that were tied up at various points throughout. And as well, we went to the local shelter that our project team had built, because, you know, a lot of these animals stand out in the sun tied up for up to 8 hours a day on market day, waiting to carry their family and their weekly purchases on the long journey back home. So the team there had built a really great shelter that owners could elect to use and pay a pretty small fee to ensure that attendants would give their animal food, water, and a bit of shade and rest while they were doing their market business for the day. So we checked that out as well, which was fantastic to see.
Gosh, how interesting. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And the team later on, because market day is only one day a week, and it's really a shame to have this beautiful, great structure sitting there empty the other 6 days of the week. So the team got really creative. And now basically a lot of these shelters run 7 days a week and have all kinds of animals sleeping sleeping in them at night. And the local vet has a place there where they're able to give services to the animals. They also sell like humane harnessing equipment and brushes. They also have a little classroom where they can give classes and training sessions. So it kind of turned into like these equine welfare centers in the town so that they're not just used the one day a week, but 7 days, which is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's great.
Yeah. So, but yeah, after we checked that out, we spent the afternoon heading out of town to visit a water point where people and animals lined up each day. Again, sometimes in the dry season for up to 8 hours, lining up to collect the water that you need to do your dishes, to do your cooking, to do anything in your household. And so the animals and typically the women and the young girls in the household would be lined up there for the day. So we would check that out. Because the team had a project where they would put in water troughs so that while the animals were waiting for their owners to collect the big jerry cans of water, the animals could get a nice refreshing drink before they carried the heavy loads back home. And then after that, we would head over to a rural community where we had active projects running. And we sat in animal owners' thatched round huts, the huts that were shared by both the entire family and the animals. And we chatted about their lives, really. I mean, the things they were proud of, the things they were struggling with, where their animal fits into both sides of that. And we'd always kind of end each of those visits checking out the animal and its resting area. That's typically how all of my trips were. It'd be the first, you know, half of the week or the first couple of days, we'd be out in the field meeting all the different stakeholders, visiting with the people and the animals. And then we'd take that long 6-hour journey back up to Addis Ababa, spend the next few days working as a team in the office. And on that particular trip, our focus was developing a new community engagement curriculum for field staff to be trained in. So really all of the information and perspectives we gathered from the field fed directly back into that. That was a 10-day trip. So when I got back to London, I spent the next few days writing a report of my trip, making sure we didn't lose that institutional knowledge of everything we learned on the trip, and then briefing fellow colleagues. And then actually the really hard work started as well of all of the follow-up work. So every visit identify loads of work to do over the next several months. And so then it would be kind of working with the team via distance while I sat in London and they in Addis Ababa or the field offices.
Wow. Okay. And so what is actually a typical day like for a horse or a donkey that's working with a family in Ethiopia?
Really depends on the work type of the animal and the specific context that they work in. It really kind of varies greatly depending on this, but I'll give an example of a typical day for a Gary horse in a town in Ethiopia where I used to work on a project. So I guess a typical day would probably consist of a 6 a.m. wake up call. The owner would give the animal a bit of food and water while they themselves have their coffee and prepare for the day ahead. And then they would harness up the animal and spend the rest of the day, up to 8 or 12 hours in many cases, giving rides to customers around the city. Some of these rides would be one or two people, but it also wouldn't be uncommon to see 6 people or more squeezing in to share a ride given by one horse. And, you know, sometimes the animals would get a midday meal, drink of water, but it's really not guaranteed. And generally their status as either a rented or an owned animal will play a role in what kind of amenities they get throughout the day, I guess. I guess the hard bit to swallow and the hardest bit to see was that, you know, rough handling and whipping sometimes of the genital area wasn't terribly uncommon in some of these horses, especially as the animals would get tired and naturally move a bit slower throughout the day. And our welfare assessment data tended to show that most of these animals were lame, were far too thin, had wounds and eye problems. So these types of things obviously made their long workday that much more challenging. Some horses then at the end of the day would have adequate stables to go home and rest in, but others have rocky, uneven, muddy rest areas with not much space or opportunity to move around. So I think the thing I want to point out about this is I know this can be really hard to hear for many people. And trust me, as an animal person myself, it was always very hard to see in person. But I think it's also important to point out that the animal owners themselves who were caring for these animals were struggling quite a bit to make ends meet for their families. And they had a standard of living themselves that most people listening to this podcast would probably really struggle to thrive within. And I say that not to try and justify anything, but I just always think it's really important not to look at animal welfare in isolation by just focusing on the animals themselves and ignoring the context in which they live. I think when this happens, we tend to just rush in and try to fix everything ourselves rather than really understand what solutions are workable for local people and help them implement these solutions themselves. In all my years, I've yet to see a fix everything ourselves type project survive after the NGO exits and moves on to work elsewhere. So I think it's really important to kind of look at both the animal and the people side and not just make snap judgments.
Where do you even start to make a difference when it's actually such a large situation that's happening in so many countries of the world, including ours?
I think this relates to my previous point about the people who own and care for these animals. You know, they themselves often live in very poor and marginalized communities, and they're really doing the best they can with what they have to provide for their families and their animals, despite the immense challenges that they face. And, you know, what I've learned through the years is every single animal owner in this world has their own unique reasons why they do or do not do certain things for their animals. And I truly believe that as animal welfare professionals, it's our job not to assume or to judge, but to make every effort to listen and understand before we act on anything. And I think sometimes people actually don't have the knowledge and skills to provide the right things in the right way for their animal. Sometimes they simply have other more pressing priorities and pressures in their life, so animal care falls a bit by the wayside. And I think other times they'd love to do more for their animals, but they simply can't afford it or don't live in an environment that enables them to do so. So I think the thing that really breaks my heart, though, is when I hear people jump to the conclusion that people simply don't care. But by now, I've worked on projects in more than 20 countries. I've spent time with more than 100 animal-owning communities, had meaningful conversations with hundreds of animal owners, and I can say pretty confidently that when you dig deep and you take the time to truly understand the situation and people's motivations and experience, I really have found that this is the exception rather than the norm.
Given all of those trips, all those conversations, how do you think people actually perceive working animals these days? Are there actually differences in different parts of the world, in different cultures? And what are they?
Yeah, so I think in my experience, this, again, it's something that varies greatly based on location and a variety of socioeconomic factors. I myself have often noticed the most tangible differences when comparing urban and rural areas, though. So in recent history, urban equines have become oftentimes a status symbol of both the cities themselves that they work in and the people who utilize them. A lot of times in more developed areas of the world, these animals are symbolic of wealth, tradition, romance, like order. You can see this pretty clearly when you walk around my favorite city, Vienna, Austria. You see imperial horse statues everywhere around every corner, horse-drawn carriages carrying the tourists around the city. But then, on the other hand, in lesser developed areas of the world, despite the fact that these animals play pretty major roles in maintaining the order of a city, working equines in cities are often viewed as symbols of backwardness, poverty, and disorder. And a lot of people in positions of power would prefer that they be hidden from sight. So we see this theme emerge pretty clearly when major cities host huge international sporting events and tend to do initiatives in advance of all the international visitors arriving, where they expel working and stray animals from the streets in the run-up to the event. In my experience, this is often very different to what happens in rural areas, where there's generally more of a cultural connection to nature and farming and animals that's still intact. So I've had donkey owners in urban areas of Kenya tell me that they're not seen as professional people who have a future, only to drive to a community half an hour away in a rural area and hear people rave about how their donkey is their pride and joy. So for me, it really is most clearly apparent the differences in how people perceive these animals based on, you know, the type of work the animals do and where they actually live and work.
I mean, is there a way that one can estimate how many animals there are in this working role around the world? And would you say that's a good thing? Is it like a bad thing? Is it actually going to change anytime soon?
Well, an estimated 200 million working animals are essential to the livelihoods of some of the poorest communities worldwide. And I think the reality is that these animals play a really indispensable role in enabling their owners to earn an income for their families, access basic services for education for their children, And they also play a pretty clear role in supporting gender equality. Now, we know the animals face a lot of welfare problems, but these problems can usually be prevented with good daily management and handling practices. So there are some contexts where I've seen, many contexts, in fact, where I've seen firsthand that these changes are possible and they can ensure that working animals have a good life. And there are some where, for a variety of factors, it might benefit both people and animals more if they were simply replaced for a different technology. But it's too complex a question to give a simple answer, I guess.
Well, maybe this next question is also a little bit difficult, but I did just want to ask, if horses, donkeys, and mules had actually not been around to help us humans throughout history, what do you think would have actually worked out differently?
Well, it's pure speculation for me, and I have no evidence to back this up, but I truly believe that the world we live in would not be nearly as developed as it is today had working animals not been around to help us humans. For centuries, these animals have played a really critical role in transportation, connecting people, goods, and markets, helping us cultivate crops, building infrastructure, accessing vital medical care and education. You know, the list really goes on and on. And humans are pretty resourceful, so I'm sure we would have eventually developed other means, but I don't think it all would have happened nearly as quickly without working animals to shoulder that load.
How interesting. Yeah, I remember this point I read in a history book once that without the horseshoe, actually a lot of the key battles or the key journeys of the world would not even have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. In short, I think these animals have allowed us to develop and thrive as a society.
For you personally, what would actually be the perfect scenario for us to thank them for that?
You know, my dream is really a world where the work these animals do is recognized and appreciated, where they're handled with compassion and provided with things that they need to live a good life. And, you know, as always, where they have access to quality and affordable veterinary care whenever they need it. You know, in this scenario, I think these animals really could continue to make the vital contributions to their families around the world, but also at the same time, spend their days free of pain and discomfort.
So a lot of people listening to this podcast would be living in a city. They would be in the US or Western Europe, and that's purely from the actual stats from the podcast. And I wanted to ask that in a context. So say one of those people, one of our listeners, they do go abroad and say they're passing by and there's an elephant ride or there's a chance to ride a camel. What is it that we can do in that moment when we do see these working animals? Are we able to actually judge whether they're being well looked after? And if they're not, what's the right way for us to do the best that we can in that short interaction?
Sure. You know, there's many things that you can do in these situations as a tourist. And I think, first of all, it's to say, take a look at the animal. The animal will always give you the signs that you need to know how that animal is doing and whether or not it's a good idea to put that animal under further work. So, you know, look for things like wounds and look for their demeanor. Do they seem really lethargic and depressed, or do they seem alert and awake? And it's sometimes hard to see under the saddle for wounds and things. Sometimes these things can be hiding under there, but you can always feel comfortable, I think, to ask the owner to show you that the animal has no wounds. I think when you see an animal that isn't in good condition, to mention to the owner that I've chosen not to take this animal because I'm not comfortable with the welfare condition of the animal. Because if you don't tell them why you're not choosing them over someone else, then they don't know that possibly there's some improvements to be made. And I think as well, when you find an animal that is in good welfare, offer praise to the owner and tell them that you appreciate that they look after their animal. Another thing you can do that's really important is to match the size. So none of these situations where we see tiny little donkeys struggling with three people on their back up really steep steps, you know, kind of take a look at your body size and the body size of the animal and try to make as much of a conscious choice as you can about what's an appropriate load for that animal. And of course, where you can report mistreatment. So if you're within a park or within a city or a town that has a tourism board or a tourism authority, even sometimes the local police, if you see mistreatment of animals, then always you can always make an effort to try and report that, because the more complaints and reports they have from tourists who are unhappy with the condition of the animals, the more likely they are to take action to address those issues. You know, there's lots of other things practically that people can do. I think both Spanna and Brooke have really excellent resources on their website that you can check out. They're really practical, really simple to understand and to use. So I would encourage you to go to their website and check out. Spanna have the Holiday Hooves Guide, and the Brooke has the Happy Horses Holiday Code. So it offers some really useful advice there as well.
Interesting. That was going to be my next question. Where do people go to get more information? Are there any other resources that you think would be useful to mention?
As I mentioned, with the Spanna and Brooke have a lot of fantastic information on their websites. And I think actually their programmatic priorities each address very specific niches within the sector that complement rather than compete with each other. So I'd recommend checking both of those out. And I think for people who want to actually delve a bit deeper into the technical side of the welfare standards that should be in place to ensure working equines have a good life, I'd actually recommend people go to the OIE website and check out the working equid standards there.
And you actually just come back from a trip this week, which was a little bit different, but I found it very, very interesting when you first told me about it. Could you let us know a little bit about what you were up to?
I just returned from a great visit to Indonesia, where IFA has been working with the Bali Animal Welfare Association on a community-based project to improve dog welfare and reduce the threat of rabies. So this project is at a really exciting stage because we've seen a lot of really great impact over the last few years, and we feel the time has come to really hand things back over to the community and to move on to other animals and people in need. So we were there kind of checking progress on the sustainable exit plan implementation, making sure things were on track there. And we were also there scoping an exciting new project on community-based disaster risk reduction with a few communities living on an active volcano. Within the last few years, these communities were hit with both an eruption that required them to evacuate for up to 6 months at a time without their animals, and then subsequently an earthquake that damaged many of their homes. And they haven't really bounced back from that yet. And so our goal is to support them in developing a plan for themselves and their animals next time disaster strikes, and identifying opportunities to help them reduce their risks and increase their resilience so that they and their animals can bounce back quicker next time this happens.
Yeah, I mean, this is the last thing a lot of people think about when they're taking their flight to Bali or being there, which is, I think it's really important that we've heard that this is actually the reality of people living there.
Absolutely.
And so what is IFA actually working on as priorities these days? And are there ways that people can get involved or find out more about that?
It's a really exciting time at IFA. We're really focusing a lot these days on projects around the world that support animals and people thriving together. And we've made a conscious choice to be quite bold and not shy away from the really big challenges facing animals these days, such as landscape conservation, wildlife crime, rescuing live animals seized in trade, and disaster response and risk reduction. So just to give an example of how this plays out in my own work, at the moment, a few of my current project areas are focusing on resolving human-wildlife conflict between endangered Barbary macaques and small-scale fruit farmers in Morocco, supporting rabies prevention and community disaster preparedness within dog and cow-owning communities in Indonesia, and engaging communities adjacent to release sites of rehabilitated jaguars in Mexico to ensure a safe and tolerant habitat for those animals. So I think this really demonstrates the incredible variety of ways that IFA helps animals and people around the world. I think a great way to find out more and get involved is to visit our website at ifaw.org and sign up to receive news and updates on our work. And I'd also recommend people check us out on social media as well. We're on all the main channels, and you can find some great info and opportunities to get involved there.
Gosh, wow, you are really doing a lot of amazing things. And congratulations on this new appointment as the trustee for Spanna too. That must be such a privilege and, absolutely totally earned by the sounds of it.
Thank you very much. And I'm really looking forward to volunteering my time there and supporting them and the amazing work that they do around the world.
Great. And is there anything else that you would actually like to say or cover for our listeners at all?
I don't think so. I think one thing that I probably mentioned and I didn't explain clearly is I mentioned the role of working equine animals and gender equality. Possibly it might help to explain that a bit more. And so I think one thing to say, these animals often, as I said, they often live in poor and marginalized communities, but their working animals are providing a critical support system to people to try and make a better life for their families. And because of working animals, some of these families have a chance to send their daughter to school rather than spending the day collecting water for the household, or allows women more time to start a small business or socialize in their community because they can spend less time gathering firewood. It allows family members, for instance, women who are giving birth that require urgent medical care to reach the hospital in time where they otherwise might not have a means to do that. So, you know, we know that it's estimated 2/3 of livestock keepers in developing countries, approximately 400 million of those are women. So really the role these animals play in taking some of the burden off of these women in their daily household chores frees up their time to do many other things of value to them and their communities and families.
I think it's great that you mentioned that, because it's always the context of, for somebody who has not been there and seen it, and you've told me a lot of things that I had no idea about today, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as a last question, I guess, so what is next for you? What are you going to be focusing on over the next few weeks?
Yeah, so I have just completed my last work trip for this calendar year, which is fantastic because it means now I can kind of get back to some tasks that have been awaiting my return. So I think in the next few weeks in the run-up to the holidays, I'll be working on requesting some research permits for some of the work that we have to do on the ground and some of our projects, and following up on some of the recent visits I've had, both in Morocco and in Indonesia, and making sure that we're keeping those projects on track. Both of them are at kind of a critical stage right now where we've just started to engage with the communities, and it's always really important during that initial phase to keep that momentum going and to help them see that we're really serious and that we're excited to work with them. Because if you let that enthusiasm die off too quickly, it can kill the whole project and they're not very interested to work with you anymore. So I'm going to be supporting the field teams from a distance over the next couple of weeks to make sure we keep that momentum going and keep pushing forward and developing those projects.
Okay, well, the last thing I wanted to say is that thank you ever so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, to find out a lot more and actually have a lot more positive feeling about what your organizations are doing around the world, but also to take away something that all of us can do. And I think something very, very positive that I've learned today is actually, yes, the people that really are taking care of their animals, we should really recognize that. And it's not something that would have actually occurred to me to do.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Olga. I really enjoyed this, actually. I was a little bit nervous, but I actually had a lot of fun, so.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Other 5 Million podcast. I really hope that what you've heard today will help you see the next working horse, donkey, or mule that you pass by in a little bit of a different light. And I hope that you might take on the advice that Melissa shared with us today and do your part in making sure that that animal is getting good care. As you know, all domesticated animals depend completely on us humans, and so we're wholly responsible for their treatment and their livelihoods. Thank you again to Melissa Leshevsky for joining us for this interview. And thanks also to Al McLeod. He's the one who introduced us, and he and Melissa were colleagues back at Brook a few years ago. And last, but not least, I also need to say thanks to Mike Vieira. He's a mutual friend of Al and myself, and I'm so grateful that you put us in touch. That's all for today. Our next episode is coming up soon, and I promise you won't need to wait another 11 months. So, until then, animal fans.